bring in a whole lot of equipment, a lot of it homemade. It's a 3.5-4 hour setup. There's a big tower that drips water, and we convert that the drips to percussion sounds. There's a device that hooks onto our fingers and converts our hearts to drum sounds. There's a typewriter that controls a piano electromechanically, and there's a whole lot of just bricolaged and put together thrift shop and conventional music gear that there's six channels of video in the show projected and on monitors. So it's a real mess. It's like we think of it as like a landscape, but it's not a managed landscape. It's more like a jungle of wires and stuff.
How did you come up with the idea of the drip machine and the heart, and how did you get it from the beat that would come out of your finger? How do you get that to a sound that comes out of the speaker?
Right. Well, the drip machine was Invisible did a residency at Elsewhere, which is an artist residency collaborative in Greensboro, and they had a leaky roof at the time, and halfway through our residency, the roof started leaking from a rainstorm, and it was this beautiful percussion symphony, and it didn't have any one or two or three or four, but somehow all these disorganized drops of water kind of found organization in our minds, and you could kind of tap your foot to it, and just really, we really got into listening. And so Elsewhere's roof was a way to kind of make that experience portable. So it's five different points from which water can drip, and I can control the different rates of dripping, and then I can send each of those drips to a different sound, or to actually one of 30 sounds.
So how long have y'all been doing this?
Since 2006. We kind of began playing more conventional instruments, but prior to 2006, Mark had made several strange instruments, but we just didn't incorporate them into the group Invisible right away until it kind of came into being part of what we wanted to do. We got more interested in unusual sounds and unusual strategies. I specifically remember when in 2007, when Mark called me up on the phone and said, "Hey, if I can make a typewriter play piano, would you be interested in collaborating on a project where we have a typist playing a piano?" And to which I said, "Yeah, if you can pull that off, then let's see what that sounds like." The Selectric Piano was born, which is an IBM Selectric 2, which was like the typewriter to have in the 60s and 70s, right?
Millions of them made. It was a pinnacle of the type of typing technology, basically.
They were everywhere. So Mark built the thing. Mark, with his collaborator Fred Snyder, who helped with some of the finer electronics, right?
Yeah.
Is that how you would phrase it, some of the finer electronics?
Yeah, Fred is better at electronics than I will ever be, and he's just brilliant about making things really solid and durable. You can make a prototype and have fun with it in your studio, but we know that we're going to travel these things and use them for years and years. So he knows how to make the electrons obey.
So Mark and Fred put together the Selectric Piano, which is basically an adapter that allows Jody, who's a professional typist, she hadn't really played a whole lot of music until she started playing with us as a typist. But so she actually spends her work hours typing, transcribing legal depositions and stuff like that. But with Invisible, when she types, it becomes music, because every letter that she types on the typewriter, every letter corresponds to one note on the piano. So, and there just happened to be, miraculously, 88 characters on the Selectric typewriter, as there are 88 keys on the piano.
Fantastic.
So, and that, Mark, and you did not know that going into the thing. Like, you found that out after you had already decided to make the thing, right?
Yeah, I had the idea and just got online and started doing a little research, and you you know, sometimes you get thrown a little crumb when you have an idea, and that was the crumb that made this, like, okay, I'm going to follow this trail. It just seemed too good to be true.
I noticed that she was capitalizing some things. Does that make a difference?
It does, yeah. All the lowercase are different from the uppercase, but it's done in a pretty logical, considerate way so that, you know, we can kind of anticipate, you know, uppercase, lowercase, and the use of symbols. And, you know, there's two periods. There's an uppercase period and a lowercase period on IBM Selectric. It's just how the mechanics work. So, yeah, both of those are different notes. There's an uppercase.
She's typing. How does the text fit in with the show?
The text is almost like it fills the role that lyrics might fill in another band. You know, there's a language aspect and language and melody are put together, but in this case they're really different. The language takes on a visual, you read it, and the melody is processed through to this typewriter and through to the piano. That's the content of the show, if you're thinking about, you know, like, but it's poetics. It's not prose. It's poetry. So it's, you know, we're working with image and concept in our written language.
And the, you know, the poetry, the lyrics, the lead singer, you know, that the lyrics kind of become, all of that was the very beginning of most of our compositions that we're playing tonight. Because obviously, when she's typing, that's making music on the piano. And so those notes, those series of notes, those melodies, kind of informed, you know, what I play on the keyboards or what Jonathan plays on the guitar. So the lyrics, the poetry, the typed content came first, like months and months and months before we played any music for this. Mark and I exchanged a lot of emails and had a lot of meetings of, like, well, what do we want to say? What do we want to type? And then we came up with a whole bunch of stuff to say and talk about, and then we sat down at the Selectric piano and typed it out and was like, well, this sounds like good music and this sounds like crazy music, so let's use a little bit of this crazy music, let's use a little bit of this good-sounding music and put it all together and make songs out of it, you know, or movements. And conceptually, a lot of what we're talking about is obsolescence, which the name of the show is The New Obsolete. So we're kind of exploring ideas of obsolescence in technology. You know, a lot of what we've seen in our lifetime. I mean, we have the Selectric was around in the 70s. We got a lot of VCRs on stage. We got a lot of tape players. It's the stuff that's still haunting thrift stores that we're kind of using, that we're using both to make our music and that we're using to kind of to talk about on the Selectric, that we're typing about. But also we wanted to explore the idea of how technology becomes obsolete and changes and evolves and adapts. Also, similarly, the human body has its own way of changing over time and kind of getting rid of things that aren't as useful now as they were a million years ago.
We have this way of thinking about ourselves in the same frame that we think about technology, where, like, you know, we live with this stuff, you know, and it's evolving faster than we are physically, just as a matter of fact. And so we largely physically stay the same, mentally stay the same. And so the changing technology makes us feel different about our own bodies and our parts and our, even like our desires or our impulses that might have been forged in a different fire are now up against a very new reality. So
yeah, like social media, and I was reading that on your phones and all of the you're getting your information now and contacting people, that it changes your brain chemistry a little bit.
It does, yeah. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. This show is not delivering a message about technology or the body. It's delivering some of the questions that we think about all day, and it turns out that a lot of other people think about them too. So it's generated some interesting conversations and some interesting responses from audience members. So.
How did you get involved with Moog Fest?
I came to Moog Fest last year and just, you know, was just, I could just see us being here. It was just like, this is where we belong. I
mean, yeah, it's a fit, for sure.
Yeah, and not just Moog Fest, but Moog Foundation, Moog Music, Moog Sound Lab, whatever, you know, like Bob Moog, his brand, his, the way that he approached instrument making, just the idea of this, of the innovation, basically, of the sound innovation, you know, that is what we're about, having seemingly impossible ideas and then making strange instruments and then finding strange ways to play those strange instruments. And I think that's a lot of what Bob Moog did. And yeah, so I, you know, many months ago contacted the Asheville Art Museum about partnering with them, because we generally play art museums and art galleries. It's kind of, that's where we are, where we find our best fit. So it worked out great, considering that here we are in the museum, and Moog Fest is right next door and right outside in the lobby there. So.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Great. Where do you, what's next for you guys? Where are you, what is the, well, nobody knows what the future holds, but what, where do you plan to take Invisible in the future?
Well, this show, The New Obsolete, has been running for about a year now. We got a grant to produce the show, and we're good at the show now. We're getting itchy to do something new, and we're applying for another grant, a composition fellowship, to compose more work to document this. So, yeah, lots of changes. Invisible doesn't look too similar from show to show. I mean, there are themes, you know, invented instrumentation, systematic composition methods, you know, text, vastly sort of multimedia approaches, but, you know, it could be that our next show would be a lot smaller, more or less musical. It's hard to say right now.
Yeah, it is kind of hard to say. Yeah. We're going to keep on doing what we do, exploring sound ideas and composing performances around those sound ideas.
I'd be interested to be in your rehearsals or your brainstorming sessions. Oh.
Bing. Yeah, there's a lot. We have
a little trip.
As you can imagine.
A trip.
As you can imagine, we have a lot of ideas that,
yeah,
you know, 90% of them don't ever see the light of day, but
the cutting room floor is deep.
Yeah, they exist on paper still. There's always the possibility.
Yeah. It's kind of a nice thing, actually. We have acres of ideas, and the fact that we can only do things so quickly is a proving ground. You know, an idea might come up, and if we could execute that second, we would, but maybe it sits around for a year or 2 years and it still seems cool. And maybe it sits around for a year or 2 years and it's like, what were we thinking?
Yeah.
And we invest so much labor and energy and money and you know, health into our shows that we're at a point right now where we've really got to know something about that investment. You know, we've got to know that we're going to get something good. And that's not necessarily all good thing, but it is what it is. You know, we don't have like infinite time, infinite money, so we've got to choose carefully. So letting ideas sit around and picking from the ones that really seem to have lasted is what has to happen.
Well, I am good. I've got plenty of content here to paste together an interview for the airs. Or anything else y'all want to talk about? before. I do want to video a demo, if you can, if you don't mind.
To video?
A demo, like maybe the drips,
oh, okay.
Or something. Or
sure.
Yeah, it's, yeah, it's...
Whatever would be.
We don't actually have good video online of the drips, so that would be...
Yeah, really the drips would be probably the thing
you
to do.
You probably can find the best stuff. I mean, we have great edited, nice stuff of this electric piano being played.
Online,
you
yeah.
Find.
You got, Mark, you got a light out on the, Yeah?
So what are they sitting on that,
It's just jars on lights.
Jars on lights? But what... Okay. I don't quite know how to ask my question. Like, how does it... The drip... And to the drum,
how's that relationship?
Yeah.
You want me to take it, Mark, since I'm over here with the thing?
Yeah.
I mean, I'll take it as far as I can take it. Elsewhere's roof is the 10 foot tall drip driven drum machine, and basically there are five different valves that drip water at different rates, just as a leaky roof. Would do. They're not connected to each other. They don't relate to each other. They're five different drips, five different
mm-hmm.
rhythms. And there are five jars underneath each of these dripping valves that collect the water, and the jars are illuminated with lights. So when the drip falls, when it hits the jar that is collecting the water, it signals a drum. An automated drum, well, not really automated, but a drum. Mark, how would you describe the drums?
Just a little electromechanical.
Electromechanical drum with, so there's like an army of these electromechanical drums surrounding the drip tower.
Mm-hmm.
So when the drips are collected in the jars, this army of drums plays the rhythm of the dripping drips.
Okay. Uh-huh.
And more specifically, up at the top here, when the drip actually leaves the valve, when it leaves that spot, it's breaking a beam of light. And it's that breaking the beam of light, it's not light that you can see, but it's that breaking that sends the signal
okay.
to the electromechanical drum.
See.
So when it actually falls into the jar, it's not actually triggering anything. The triggering is happening up top.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So that kind of clears
but
that
it
up.
Yes, it does.
Because we have it on